Lecture 44, Alexander the Great, Youth, Early Kingship.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Alexander the Great was born in July 356, the son of Philip's fourth wife, Olympias, from Epirus. He was not the eldest son, he had a brother, Arideus, whose mother, Philina of Larissa, had married Philip a year before Olympias. Alexander is probably the most famous figure from antiquity after Jesus Christ, and history has called Alexander Great for centuries. We cannot consider Alexander's reign in anything like the detail it deserves. It, and that of Philip for that matter, merits a course by itself. Nevertheless, Alexander's importance in Greek history is so great, no pun intended, that any course like ours must consider his exploits. Since all but the first 2 years of Alexander's reign was spent in Asia, his contacts with the mainland Greek states were minimal. However, there are events taking place in Athens that we will also consider as part of our course. What I propose to do with Alexander is not give simply a blow-by-blow account of his reign. You can get this from reading any biography of Alexander, especially mine, so there's another book for your Oikos shelves. Instead, I want to do with Alexander what I've done with various people and things during our course, and that is question. So, for example, I've argued that despite his major accomplishments, Solon was ultimately unsuccessful, and that Pericles was not as great a leader as many modern historians think. And I've argued that Cleon was a good leader, and that Philip II was a great king. Arguably, I'd say that Philip was Macedonia's greatest king, not Alexander. With Alexander, I'm going to address the question of his greatness, because the problem is that it's very hard to get to the real person. Over the centuries, all sorts of stories were attached to Alexander, and the historical king quickly faded into one of legend. He was called great because of his military successes, but over time his greatness extended to other aspects of him as a king and as a person. So I'm going to discuss various events of his reign in Greece and in Asia, which I think are representative of him and his reign as a whole. And I'm going to use these as a backdrop to assess whether he still deserves to be called great. And so yes, heresies are going to be rampant in this and the next few lectures. In this lecture, I'm going to look at Alexander's youth, his accession to the Macedonian throne in 336, and the first turbulent couple of years of his reign as king. Now, all sorts of miraculous stories surrounded Alexander's conception and birth, and these were designed to show his superhuman status even before he was born. They'll provide us with vivid examples of the problems we face when studying the reign of Alexander, because it's by no means certain that these stories were circulating at the time of his birth. I believe that Alexander put them out later when he began to believe in his own divinity to show that he was no ordinary mortal from the word go. And we will return to this line in a later lecture. One of these stories has it that the night before Olympias and Philip married, she dreamed that there was a violent thunderstorm during which a thunderbolt struck her in the womb. This was followed by a blinding flash of lightning. Philip later dreamed that he'd sealed up his wife's womb with wax, and that later he saw on the wax an impression of the figure of a lion. It was prophesied that Olympias was pregnant from Zeus, hence the thunderbolt and the lightning, and that she would give birth to someone with the bravery of a lion. Another story is that one night Philip spied Olympias in bed with a huge snake. The snake was Zeus in disguise. This was not that unusual. Remember, the Greeks believed that the gods often popped down to earth and assumed human or animal form. Zeus was believed to take the guise of a snake sometimes when he came to earth. Anyway, soon after this incident, that's Philip seeing Olympias in bed with a snake, Olympias became pregnant with Alexander. Then when Alexander was being born, the temple of Artemis at Ephesus in modern Turkey burned down. It did so, the story goes, because the goddess had left her temple to help deliver Alexander into the world. The magi in charge of the temple saw something else in the fire that destroyed it. They saw the temple's destruction as an omen that the Persian Empire was doomed to fall to the man whom Artemis was bringing into the world that day. Now, these stories are obviously false. I don't think snakes impregnate women. But they give us excellent examples of how Alexander saw himself. Regardless of when these stories began to circulate, they were meant to show Alexander was born of a divine father, that Philip was only his mortal father, not his real one. And this is all part and parcel of Alexander's pretensions to personal divinity. Stories to exaggerate Alexander as a person and his achievements, and indeed both, continued throughout his life. A good example is the taming of his horse Bucephalus, which means ox head. So obviously the head resembled an ox. When Alexander was perhaps 11 or 12, we don't know for certain, a Thessalian man brought the horse to Pella to sell to Philip. Because the horse refused to let anyone ride him and it reared up to kick anyone who came near him, Philip wasn't interested in the deal. Now, the story goes that Alexander pestered his father to let him try to ride that horse. He'd noticed that Bucephalus was startled by his own shadow in front of his face. So Alexander approached him slowly, did a bit of horse whispering, whatever that means, and turned him to face the sun. This meant that the horse's shadow was now behind him. No one else appeared to have noticed what Alexander did, and his little trick had a calming effect on Bucephalus. The horse allowed Alexander to mount and ride him. Now, this whole incident had attracted quite a crowd by then, including Philip, and everyone was taken aback by Alexander's success. Philip was apparently in tears, and he prophesied that his son would go on to do great things, and that Macedonia was not big enough to hold him. Well, again, truth or fiction? We know that Alexander did have a horse called Bucephalus, which he acquired when he was a young boy. The horse was Alexander's until he died from wounds in the Battle of the Hydaspes River in India in 326. So he lived to be a ripe old age for a horse. But whether Alexander tamed him this way is unknown. Was Alexander really the only person out of seasoned adult cavalrymen, not to mention the horse dealer who presumably knew his way around horses, was Alexander the only person who noticed the effect of the shadow on Bucephalus? So this whole incident could be a story put out to show Alexander's intuition and that even from an early age, he was fated to do great things. Alexander was taught to hunt, to fight, and to ride like other Macedonian youths. Hunting was a major social pastime for the Macedonians. They hunted boar, foxes, lion, and birds. One of the mosaics from the capital at Pella is of Alexander and his friend Craterus hunting a lion. Actually, the lion has the upper hand, or rather upper paw, because it's in the middle of the mosaic, and one of its paws is on top of the left foot of the figure to its right. That figure is Alexander, so he's actually trapped by the lion. Craterus, to the left of the lion on the mosaic, rushes in, wielding his sword to try to save Alexander. Now, this mosaic is from the early Hellenistic period, so it post-dates Alexander by a few years. But it's testimony to Alexander's love of a hunt, which continued throughout his reign. It's also testimony to the high quality of Macedonian artists, especially those who produced mosaics. There are some beautiful examples of mosaics from Pella that are still on site, actually on the ground in houses that are being excavated, as well as some hanging in the museum at Pella. And I would really urge you, ladies and gentlemen, to visit northern Greece and to visit these sites. Pella is spectacular. Now, when Alexander turned 14 in 342, his father Philip hired Aristotle, the foremost philosopher of the day, to be his tutor. Aristotle was already known to Philip because Aristotle's father was the personal physician to Amyntas III, Philip's father. And after his father died, Aristotle kept up contact with the Macedonian kings. Aristotle would tutor Alexander for 3 years, not at Pella, but on Philip's orders at Mysa, part of the gardens of Midas on the slopes of Mount Vermion. Exactly why Philip decided that this should be Alexander's boarding school, to call it that, is unknown. But it may have something to do with Philip's imminent departure for Thrace and the desire to get Alexander away from the influence of his mother Olympias. Because of Philip's near constant campaigning, he and Alexander spent little time together while Alexander was growing up. There was very little father-son bonding. And Alexander came to be influenced greatly by Olympias, who hated Philip, and she criticized him to Alexander all the time. Now, Philip didn't know how long he would be in Thrace, and so he may well have wanted to settle his son and heir out of the clutches of Mom, who hated him. Aristotle would have built on Alexander's education by probably teaching him philosophy, rhetoric, zoology, and geometry. And Aristotle had a lot to work with. Alexander was a voracious reader. He'd already read much Greek literature. Homer was his Bible, and Euripides was his favorite tragic playwright. When Alexander left for Asia in 334, he took with him Aristotle's copy of the Iliad, which he apparently kept in a box under his pillow alongside a dagger when he went to bed at night time. I think half of this is a story again, because you try sleeping with a box and a book under your pillow. It's too uncomfortable. But I can believe that Alexander slept with a dagger under his pillow. Then in 340, Philip besieged Byzantium, as we know, and he needed Alexander back in Pella. Alexander was now 16, and Philip appointed him regent of Macedonia while he was campaigning against Byzantium. Now, Philip also ordered two of his senior generals, Antipater and Parmenion, to stay in Pella, so they were probably meant to keep an eye on Alexander, to deal with any trouble that arose in a way that a 16-year-old who'd spent the last 3 years wandering around in gardens talking about triangles or parts of animals couldn't handle. Well, trouble did come. We've mentioned this before. It came in the shape of an apparent revolt by the Medians, a Paeonian tribe on the upper Strymon River. Antipater and Parmenion quickly discovered they were second fiddles to Alexander, because Alexander immediately led an army against the Medians and defeated them. He then moved people from Macedonia into Median territory, settling them in a new military outpost. City is the wrong word. This military outpost, remember, he named after himself, Alexandropolis. Now, this isn't bad for a 16-year-old who's been wandering around in gardens for the last 3 years. We don't know how Philip reacted to Alexander's campaign, especially his audacity in naming a foundation after himself. I'm not entirely sure, by the way, that Alexander's campaign took Philip by surprise, because after it, Antipater and Parmenion reduced three other Thracian tribes. It's possible, I believe, that all three of them, that's Alexander, Antipater, and Parmenion, were following Philip's orders, that they were supposed to engage these Thracian tribes, that there wasn't a revolt or anything like that. And if this is true, it puts a very different light on Alexander's campaign. That's why I said apparent revolt earlier. And I think it gives us a glimpse into Philip's relationship with Alexander, but that relationship as king versus heir. I think Philip wanted to test his son's mettle in battle, to see if he could pull it off, even at this relatively early age. Remember, Macedonian kings were warrior kings. Alexander by now was regent of Macedonia. He was the heir to the throne. He'd be the next king. So I think Philip wanted to see if he could also fulfill the role as warrior king. Now, 2 years later, in 338, Alexander, at the age of 18, commanded the left flank of the Macedonian army at the Battle of Chaeronea. He was in charge of the companion cavalry, no less. And we know by now that Philip didn't make hasty or bad decisions. That means that Philip clearly believed his son was up to the job of leading the companion cavalry. As we know, Alexander led the attack that broke the right flank of the Greek line at Chaeronea, and he and the Macedonians in his force annihilated the 300-strong crack Theban sacred band. After the battle, Philip ordered Alexander to lead the diplomatic embassy to the Athenians to return the ashes of the citizens who died in battle and the prisoners taken at it, and to receive the Athenians' surrender. Now, there's no question that Philip was grooming Alexander as heir to the throne. However, as we talked about in the last lecture, after Chaeronea, relations between Alexander and Philip soured very quickly. Philip's reaction to Attalus's taunting of Alexander at the wedding feast in 337 and the possible implications for Alexander's succession, should Philip and Cleopatra have a boy, seem to have upset and worried Alexander and Olympias to no small extent. Alexander also began to feel marginalized at court, because he saw Philip growing closer to the likes of Parmenion and Attalus as a sort of inner circle, while Alexander, although being heir apparent, was very much on the outside of this circle. Now, all of these things probably combined to turn his emulation of his father as the warrior king par excellence to a feeling of resentment. What seems to have been the straw that broke the camel's back was when Alexander discovered he wasn't going to Asia. Instead, he was to have a desk job, remaining behind as regent of Macedonia and Greece. Now, it's no surprise that Philip needed someone whom he could trust to be in charge of Macedonia, to be deputy hegemon of the League of Corinth. And a factor in his thinking was probably the danger to the Macedonian throne if he and Alexander both went to Asia and were killed over there. But Philip's decision couldn't have angered and disappointed Alexander more. Alexander used to say to his friends, remember, that while Philip was alive, there'd be nothing great for him, Alexander, to achieve. Philip was showing no signs of slowing down, so who knew what his achievements would be? Who knew what glory he'd win for himself? What Alexander did know was that he was not going to win any military glory while sitting around in Pella. Now, who does this remind you of? I'm thinking of Alcibiades. Remember, Alcibiades was out to win military renown for himself. He knew he could never do this while Athens was at peace. Sicily was the opportunity Alcibiades had been waiting for, just as Asia was for Alexander. So as youths, I see a fair bit of similarity between Alcibiades and Alexander, don't you think? With all of these factors in mind, I've got little problem in believing Alexander and his mother played a role in Philip's assassination in 336. After all, I find it significant that when Alexander left Pella after Attalus's slur, he went first to Epirus with his mother, but then he went on to Macedonia's long-term enemy, Illyria. Now, something's going on here. And then in 331, when Alexander visited the oracle of Zeus Ammon in the Libyan desert, he asked whether all of the murderers of his father had been punished. And the god said yes. Now, this is a very odd question to ask 5 years after the event, unless some sort of mud was still sticking to Alexander about suspicions of him being implicated in his father's death. And this was a sort of mud that only a god could wipe off in people's minds by saying, yes, they've all been punished. Alexander was present at Agai when his father was killed. His friends immediately rushed to protect him, and that was the natural thing to do. Because in the chaos and confusion of Philip's murder, who knows if Pausanias might have had an accomplice who was out for Alexander as well. But there was no attack on the young heir, and Antipater proclaimed him king, which the assembly endorsed soon after. So Alexander became king of Macedonia at the age of 20 in 336. Now, when news of Philip's death reached the Greeks, they revolted from the League of Corinth. Moreover, we're told that not everyone was in favor of Alexander's accession, so perhaps there were possible contenders to the throne. Alexander then had a lot on his plate all of a sudden. So he began a purge of possible opponents, a purge that lasted well into the next year, 335. And having set the wheels in motion for this purge, he quickly buried his father at Agai and then executed the three sons of the assassin Pausanias. Now, under Macedonian law, a traitor's family was also executed, regardless of whether it was part of a plot or not. Now Alexander turned to deal with the Greeks. Philip had placed a lot of stock in diplomacy, as we've talked about, but Alexander was rather different, and besides, he didn't have the time. Like his father, Alexander used speed to surprise his opponents, and within a matter of a few weeks, he'd ended the Greek revolt by a combination of diplomacy and force. He didn't punish the Greeks, though, but at Corinth, he resurrected the League of Corinth with himself as its hegemon, and the Greeks swore that oath of loyalty to him. He also told the Greeks that he was planning to continue with his father's invasion of Asia. Now, it was during his time in Corinth that Alexander apparently visited Diogenes, the Cynic philosopher. Diogenes was the man who lived as ascetic a life as possible, wearing little or no clothing, and often lived in a barrel. That got him the nickname of the dog, because he lived like a dog, trying to be self-sufficient. Now, the Greek word for dog is kuon, which gives us the word cynic, hence the cynic philosophy that Diogenes practiced. Now, Diogenes was famous, not least for his quirky habits. For example, he used to walk through city streets with a lighted lamp by day, looking for a good man. That means a morally good man. When Diogenes and Alexander met, the story goes that Alexander asked Diogenes whether he could do anything for him. Diogenes was sunbathing at the time, so obviously he was out of his barrel. And he replied to Alexander, "Yes, you can step aside, please, because you're blocking the sun." Alexander admired Diogenes, and he allegedly said that if he were not Alexander, he would want to be Diogenes. Now, Alexander returned to Pella after the resurrection of the League of Corinth, but before long, he was involved in a campaign against the Triballi. Now, his motive was perhaps revenge for the defeat that the Triballi had inflicted on Philip in 339. Remember, this was the battle where Philip was severely wounded in the leg. We shouldn't rule out, though, another motive, perhaps, and that's Alexander as king wanting to win the confidence of his army in battle, wanting to lead his men in battle for the first time as king. Now, and the campaign against the Triballi, by the way, was successful. But while it was going on, the Illyrians revolted, and they prepared to invade Macedonia. Sounds like a crack record, doesn't it? So Alexander immediately led an army into Illyria, and he was gaining the upper hand against the Illyrians when he received word that the Thebans had revolted again. Now talk about never rains but pours. Now, if you remember, after the Battle of Chaeronea, Philip had set up a pro-Macedonian oligarchy supported by a Macedonian garrison in Thebes. It appears that a group of democrats who'd been exiled at that time returned to Thebes in 335, and they persuaded the people to overthrow this oligarchy and to besiege the Macedonian garrison on the Cadmea, that's the Acropolis of Thebes. They then called on the Greeks to arms against the, quote, tyrant of Greece. There's also the likelihood that the Persian king, Darius III, had sent money to support a Greek revolt. If this is true, he obviously wanted to stop Alexander's invasion, which he must have been taking seriously. Now, the Theban action was a serious threat to Alexander, and it was one that he couldn't ignore. It had the potential to bring in other Greek states. And in Athens, there was some debate in the assembly about supporting Thebes. In the end, the Athenians didn't support the city. Moreover, the revolt was also going to delay Alexander in invading Asia. And this annoyed him greatly because patience was not one of his virtues. So Alexander immediately broke off the Illyrian campaign, and he took some 30,000 infantry and 300 cavalry, and he marched south to Thebes in Boeotia at such speed that he covered the 250 miles in 13 days. Now, this is really motoring. Given the terrain, the fact that there are no tunnels through mountains or modern roads or anything like that. In fact, Alexander marched so fast that the Thebans at first didn't believe it was him before their gates because he'd come from Illyria so quickly. Well, Alexander gave the Thebans one chance to surrender, and when they didn't, he besieged the city. After some initial reversals, Thebes fell to Alexander, and during this time, 6,000 Thebans were killed and 30,000 were taken prisoner. Apparently, the Macedonians lost only 500 men. Then Alexander turned over the punishment of Thebes to the League of Corinth. Well, he actually didn't. He turned it over to only a handful of states, members of the League of Corinth, that had suffered terribly at Thebes' hands in the past. And these states, of course, knew what was in Alexander's mind. And they also now could have their revenge on Thebes. And so they ordered the total destruction of the city. So what Alexander was doing was cynically exploiting these members to make it look as though Thebes' destruction was a league decision and had nothing to do with him. Now, the message from the raising of Thebes was clear. Defiance of Alexander would meet with terrible consequences. And this is echoed in the ancient sources. Diodorus, for example, says, and I quote here, "Thebes' destruction presented possible rebels among the Greeks with a terrible warning." And it did the trick, because in 331, Agis III of Sparta tried to unite Greece against Macedonia, and he failed dismally. So this was the way that Alexander kept the Greeks cowed, even when he was campaigning in Asia and as far east as what the Greeks called India. They remembered the destruction of Thebes, and they didn't want that happening to them. With Greece finally secure, Alexander could plan for the Asian expedition, and he intended to invade Asia in the following spring. In the meantime, the last of his opponents, real or imaginary, was put to death. Among them was Amintas, the true heir to the throne in 359. So he's finally bundled out of the picture. And another victim was Attalus. Alexander sent a letter to Parmenion, who was still in Asia with the vanguard force, and this letter contained orders for Parmenion to kill Attalus. And Parmenion did this as soon as he read the letter. And so Alexander finally got his revenge on Attalus for the insulting comments that he'd thrown at Alexander and his mother at that wedding feast in 337. It's interesting, by the way, that Alexander spared his own half-brother, Arrhidaeus, the son of Philip and Philina of Thessaly. And Arrhidaeus continued to live at court and didn't give Alexander any trouble at all. Well, a lot's happened in the first 2 years of Alexander's kingship, but there's even more to come. Over the winter of 335, Alexander fine-tuned his plans for the invasion of Asia. And in the spring of 334, he was all set to go. He'd already proved his battle prowess in Greece, but that was nothing compared to his spectacular victories in Asia. And it's these victories and his generalship, was it really great, that we'll discuss in our next lecture. Thank you so much.